Lebanese protesters scuffle with police in Beirut after Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri fails to form a new government. Colombian police say that mercenaries involved in the assassination of the Haitian president were hired to capture him and hand him over to the U.S. And at least 67 people die in heavy rains and flooding in western Germany and Belgium as one of the worst weather disasters in decades hits the region. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Protesters have clashed with security forces in Beirut after Lebanese Prime Minister designate Saad Hariri abandons his bid to form a new government. The Lebanese security forces say a soldier was injured during the clashes. The demonstrators were blocking roads and setting fire to trash cans and tires. Hariri quit forming his government after consultations with President Michel Aoun, saying the two could not reach a consensus. This marks another setback for Beirut's efforts to end almost 9 months of political deadlock amid the country's economic crisis. The country's been without a formal government since the deadly explosion in Beirut last August. Lebanon faces what the World Bank has called one of the worst economic crises in modern history. Political commentator Deneji Djajic says the political deadlock in Lebanon is partly due to the sectarian ruling system in the country.
One of the reasons why Hariri was not able to form any government is, of course, based on sectarian representative system of the parliament in Lebanon and the particular unwritten rules that there are in the distribution of the sects within the formation of a government. So there are various components that need to be taken into consideration, none of which have been able to work out, and this has been a repetitive story because it's not the first time that he resigns. As was mentioned, he resigned in 2017 when he was kidnapped by Saudi Arabia. He resigned again in 2019 when mass protests broke out against his government. So the crisis that Lebanon is faced with is not only the recent one of Hariri being unable to form a government, but it has been ongoing. Has this put the country in a situation where it is right now, with a daily increase in poverty, with the inflation skyrocketing, and a political deadlock that does not seem to go anywhere near a solution.
Israel's new Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has relaunched a controversial project to construct over 3,400 settler units in the occupied West Bank. The so-called E1 project involves construction of the units at an area where hundreds of Palestinians live. Mona Candiel reports from the West Bank.
Israel has advanced a major settler building project known as E1. Israel's new Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, has relaunched the controversial project for the construction of over 3,412 settler units in the occupied West Bank to connect the largest Israeli settlement of Ma'ale Adumim to the West Jerusalem Al-Quds. The project was first pushed forward by former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Palestinians have slammed the move as seriously dangerous.
Now, as Bennett bring it on the table, it is just to show the settlers that he's better than Netanyahu. He's continued the main strategy and the ideology of the settlements in the West Bank. Netanyahu has been freezing or a little bit slowed down the working in the UN, but they are now pushing it forward. This is a very dangerous colonial project in the West Bank. This will be totally cut off and divided the West Bank between the north and the south. So it's very sensitive, very strategic.
Israeli authorities have been seeking to expel tens of thousands of Palestinian Bedouins to other Palestinian towns since long time ago because the area has been allocated to E1 settlement constructions. This area sits on roughly 15 square kilometers of land northeast of Jerusalem Al-Quds. For years, the Israeli regime has tried to dismantle the Bedouin communities to make way for its massive E1 settlement project in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The planned Israeli building in E1 would effectively cut the West Bank in half and prevent Palestinian sovereign contiguity between northern and southern West Bank.
The project comes in line with Israel's annexation plan. The new regime in Israel is seeking to disrupt any territorial integrity of a future Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders. To this end, it displaces more Palestinians in violation of all international laws.
Palestinians say that it's very clear that Bennett is even worse than Netanyahu, as he started rapidly to carry out his agenda to expand illegal settlements in the occupied territories even more vigorously.
During Netanyahu's term in office, Israeli-only roads were built as first step in constructing settlements in the controversial E1 zone. Now Bennett has revived the plan and the actual construction for E1. Palestinians warned this project would practically cut the occupied West Bank in half. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Colombia's police helping Haiti in the investigation of President Jovenel Moise's assassination have made new revelations about the operation, saying that the initial intention of the gunman was to capture the president alive.
The captured Colombian ex-military officers claim that the plan was to arrest the president and hand him over to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. The information we have is that they would have been divided into two groups of approximately seven Colombians, the first entering the house of the president and the others providing security.
Now, Colombian police added that they are now looking for three people who have been in Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Meanwhile, Haitian police say the murder was planned in a neighboring Dominican Republic. They announced the main bodyguard and three other members of the slain president's staff were arrested. Colombian intelligence agents are cooperating with Haitian authorities in investigating the July 7th murder. Two Americans of Haitian descent and 26 Colombians took part in the operation at the president's home in Port-au-Prince. Political commentator Lajos Szasdy says that those plotted to assassinate President Jovenel Moise wanted to deceive the investigators and public opinion.
It looks like whoever ordered this crime, the murder of the president of Haiti, wanted investigators, public opinion, to get the wrong idea of who might be really behind the murder. Using Colombians, then the first impression will be, well, that maybe those who ordered the murder came from Colombia, that the idea was, the plan was created or brainstormed, let's say, in Colombia, which I don't think. I mean, everything is possible, but I'll try to explain myself.
Now, these 67 people have been killed as torrential rains have poured on Western Europe, causing widespread flooding. Germany's reported 59 deaths, while Belgium has confirmed 8. Dozens of people are still missing. German officials expect water levels on the Rhine and Moselle rivers to rise even further over the next couple of days. Some 200,000 people, or households, I should say, are still without power in western parts of Germany. Army has been deployed to try to help with rescue efforts. Evacuation orders have also been issued for parts of the region. Neighboring Luxembourg and the Netherlands have also been hit by floods in one of the worst disasters to hit the region in decades. The UN Refugee Agency says the situation of Eritrean refugees living in Ethiopia's Tigray region is rapidly deteriorating. Agency voiced concern over the escalation of fighting in the region in recent days. It said that tens of thousands of Eritrean refugees are now fearful for their lives due to the insecurity and ongoing movement of troops in the area. Local fighters in Tigray have been engaged in a conflict with government troops in the area since November. Nearly 100,000 refugees from Eritrea were living in camps in the area when fighting erupted. And now joining us out of Washington for more on the story is Mr. Netfa Freeman from the Black Alliance for Peace Movement. Help our, understand exactly what's going on with Tigray region, with the Ethiopians, and how the Eritrean refugees are caught up in the middle of this.
Well, this is a fairly complex situation, and I think too often the Western forces are left out, and some would say, put the West in everything and blame the West, but their hands are in everything. This is a very octopus type of, situation we're dealing here, but you know, trying to simplify it is kind of hard. So I think it begins this current situation that we see people being reported the most right now. It began on, you could say, November 3rd of 2020, when the TPLF, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, attacked the military bases in the northern part of Ethiopia, Meleke, and then also fortified themselves militarily by stealing, you know, taking the weapons and everything, and then they engaged, you know, obviously the federal government or any kind of government, you know, when something happens like that, they're going to engage. It started the fighting, and so a lot of people, you know, in that taking over that thing were killed, soldiers were killed, and so that started the fighting. Really, you know, that even goes back before this current government that's in power. So the TPLF, which were in power before, maybe like 20 years or a little over 20 years, they were engaged in a war between Eritrea and what was the Ethiopian government. And the new government stopped that war, and the TPLF, which I think we should be careful of not thinking of as synonymous with, you know, because people will say synonymous with the Tigray people, because their interests and whatnot are pretty defined, and they're not really in the interest of a people. So they're not really a People's Liberation Front. And so right now we're seeing the contention between the TPLF, which has been waging war and trying to take reassume power or be a secession group. They've been supported by the West, particularly United States, which has mischaracterized the situation and actually see it as an opportunity for them to come and control the Horn of Africa. And recently there was a ceasefire declared. It was about a month ago, or maybe less than a month ago, I can't remember exactly. And that now what we're seeing, there have been reports of the TPLF and other, you know, militias leveling reprisals against their own, against Tigrayans who had been working with the local interim government, which is, you know, part of the federal government. And so none of that gets reported. I think the UN report, or just the UN bodies, they can kind of complicate things by not looking at the broader context and complications of intentions or the contentions in a place, and sort of boiling it down to just what certain governments should do or certain forces, including the TPLF. So they oversimplify it and don't really deal with the broader geopolitical and geostrategic interests of other players that are trying to get dominance in the Horn of Africa.
Thank you. A great input there. Very enlightening. I want to appreciate having you on, Mr. Netford Freeman there from the Black Alliance for Peace Network, joining us from Washington. Meanwhile, the South African government says 117 people have been killed in the country's week-long unrest as security forces struggle to quell the violence. The figure shows a sharp rise from the toll of 72 announced just yesterday. A government official said the commercial hub of Johannesburg is now relatively calm. However, the KwaZulu-Natal province is still volatile. Meanwhile, South Africa's army is preparing to deploy 25,000 troops to assist police in tackling the emergency. South Africa plunged into chaos after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself in to serve a 15-month jail term that is for contempt of court. Authorities say that hundreds of people have been arrested in connection with looting, arson, and violence.
South Africa has been in utter chaos since last Thursday, a day after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself in to authorities to serve a 15-month jail term. Zuma was convicted of contempt of court after he defied an order to testify before a judicial commission probing allegations of fraud during his years in office. The former leader's imprisonment sparked protests across much of South Africa. The unrest soon escalated into mayhem. In the past 7 days, more than 800 retail shops and over 200 shopping malls have been looted. Government estimates suggest hundreds of millions of dollars of goods have been purloined or destroyed. That has sparked fears of a looming humanitarian crisis, with authorities warning that parts of South Africa may soon be running short of basic provisions. Analysts believe this could be a further blow to the nation's economy, already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
What can come out of this, of course, would be even further economic crises in South Africa. Amid this COVID-19 third wave, which has impacted South Africa more than any other country on the African continent.
The South African Army has already deployed thousands of troops to help overstretched police restore order. That proving insufficient, the government has called another 25,000 Army Reserve troops to tackle the emergency. In addition, people in areas worst hit by the violence have taken up arms and formed vigilante groups to protect their neighborhoods. South Africa is experiencing one of its worst crises since the end of apartheid regime in early 1990s. With the former president in prison, high unemployment, and much of the country plagued by crime, it is hard to imagine an easy path back to normalcy.
The World Health Organization says the COVID pandemic is far from over, warning of the global spread of new and possibly more dangerous variants of the virus. WHO chief was quoting a report by the agency's emergency committee. The warning comes as the coronavirus continues to wreak havoc throughout the world. The virus has killed more than 4 million people since first emerging in China back in December 2019. Global infection rate has soared to over 500,000 daily cases, largely driven by the more contagious Delta variant. Now, that variant has reappeared in places long believed to have dodged the worst of the pandemic, including Australia. Countries where healthcare infrastructure remains limited are under severe pressure, particularly in Africa. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Coronavirus cases are rising in several American states like Nevada, where vaccinations lag and the Delta variant is spreading. It now accounts for half of U.S. cases. We now present you an article written by Victoria Bekempis under the heading COVID outbreak among vaccinated Vegas hospital workers underscores Delta risks. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. An outbreak of COVID-19 among vaccinated staffers at a Las Vegas hospital has highlighted the risk posed by the Delta variant of the virus in the United States, as Nevada struggles with rising COVID cases and stagnating vaccination rates. Hospital officials confirmed to The Guardian 11 workers at the Sunrise Hospital and Medical Center, only one of whom was unvaccinated, tested positive for coronavirus after attending a party in early June. Sunrise's Chief Executive Officer Todd Sklamberg said in a statement, "The Center for Disease Control, the CDC, has confirmed that 11 of our colleagues at Sunrise Hospital tested positive for the COVID-19 Delta variant, claiming all who tested positive are doing well and have returned to work." The Chief Executive Officer of Sunrise, Todd Sklamberg, added, "We want to acknowledge our colleagues recognized their own symptoms, similar to allergies or the common cold, and chose to get tested. There were no exposures to our patients, and our staff complies with all personal protection equipment guidelines, masking at all times and wearing face shields with all patient encounters." The outbreak, first reported by the Las Vegas Review-Journal, comes amid growing concern in the United States about the Delta variant of the coronavirus, which is now the dominant variant in the country. Because the Delta variant is highly transmissible, authorities have said it's all the more important for unvaccinated people to get their shots, both for personal immunity reasons and to prevent spreading COVID-19 to others. The variant is now being blamed for surges in southern Missouri and northern Arkansas, now the largest U.S. outbreak of new COVID cases. According to the National Public Radio, NPR, authorities have warned that it will only worsen if vaccination rates continue to languish in these areas. While there have been breakthrough cases, health officials have repeatedly claimed that vaccinations provide strong protection, including against the Delta variant of the coronavirus. U.S. authorities claim COVID-19 vaccines, which data have repeatedly shown are safe and effective, reduce the severity of the virus and prevent hospitalizations in the rare breakthrough cases. Mark Pandori, the Nevada State Public Health Laboratory Director, has said that one factor in this breakthrough incident might be the Delta variant's heightened ability to avert immunity. Mark Pandori told the Review Journal, "The viruses that are circulating in July aren't the viruses that were circulating in February. These are the Olympians now." He added, "The ones that are circulating now have a better ability to get around vaccination." Concerns about the Delta variant of the coronavirus affecting people who have been fully vaccinated come as Nevada struggles to contain a rise in cases. The Las Vegas Review-Journal notes on Tuesday, 13th of July, Nevada health officials reported 855 new cases, with the state's two-week positivity rate hitting 10%, a surge from 9th of June low of 3.3%. Brian Labers, an epidemiologist and assistant professor at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas School of Public Health, said that 60% of Nevada cases sequenced were now the Delta variant. Several weeks ago, the Delta variant comprised just 16% of sequenced cases. Brian Labers, the epidemiologist, added, "Delta is clearly the dominant strain in Nevada," adding, "Over the past month, our numbers have been continually trending upwards, and the Delta variant is obviously contributing to that." Brian Labers noted that when you couple that with low immunization rates and our community being open 100%, you have the right conditions for that kind of COVID spread. Nevada health officials say that 46.01% of Nevadans aged 12 and older have completed vaccinations, and 54.46% have initiated vaccinations. According to health officials, this refers to the number of first doses given. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, across the United States, 65% of those 12 and older have received at least one dose of the vaccine, while 56.3% are fully vaccinated. Brian Labus, an epidemiologist, says the rates we're seeing right now of vaccination are nowhere where we need to be to stop transmission. These percentages also fall far lower than what is probably required for herd immunity, a metric that has shifted upwards with the pandemic's continuation and Delta variant's ascent. Brian Labus added, this variant is probably pushing that number higher because it spreads much more easily. Meanwhile, the Nevada Independent reports younger Nevadans are the least likely to receive vaccines, presenting a challenge as they are most likely to be out and about. The website says only half of Nevadans aged between 20 and 59 have received their first jab, compared with more than 75% of residents aged 60 and older. In response, Nevada's governor, Steve Sisolak, announced on 1st of July that the state would seek help from the federal government, noting that the White House has announced its intention to send surge teams to hard-hit areas. A statement from Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak's office says Nevada is working with federal agencies to ramp up its initiatives to vaccinate more people. According to a report by the Nevada Hospital Association, there are a few positive signs. The increase seems to be contained to southern Nevada, which has the most medical resources in the state, and personal protection equipment supply flow is not in a state of chaos. The organization claims patients are less sick, seem to be spending less time in the hospital, and are not requiring intensive care or mechanical ventilation as frequently as in the past. The bad news is there is no current signal that indicates this news is slowing down, noting that the majority of the hospitalized patients are reportedly unvaccinated people.
Back to reality. It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality, brought to you by the one and only IRB English Radio. In the studio with me, I have the pleasure and honor of hosting two wonderful guests. To my left is
Muzaffar Haider from the UK.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, bro.
Wa alaikum salam.
Thank you for joining us. And to the right of the ring,
Hassanain from India. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so very much, you guys, for being with us. I'm Zainab. We are going to be talking about something that I was really passionate to bring up. What do you think is the best job and lifestyle for introverts and extroverts? Brother Hassanain, do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
It depends on upon the different situations.
No, generally yourself. I mean, obviously not.
Okay, I consider myself as an extrovert.
Yeah, I consider you as an extrovert too. Brother Lafar.
I don't know. I really.
You
don't
are
know.
Definitely an extrovert.
No, I'm not.
No, you're a tired extrovert, is what you are.
That's it.
We're not experts. We're just talking off our own personal experience. Mm-hmm. I'm an introvert. Brother Hassanain is a total extrovert. And Brother Muzaffar is on the fence, you know?
Yeah, I'm in the middle, yeah.
Yeah, he's like an extrovert leaning toward being an introvert. Brother Muzaffar, the question I wanted to ask you
was that whether you're making active changes to your life to cater better to now your now new personality. And you said what?
I wasn't really sure. I said that I am making changes within myself, but I don't know if they're conscious or subconscious. See, I think it's cyclical, sister. I think everybody goes through these cyclical phases. And we were discussing just before we went on air that even introverts with a select few will become very extroverted. I think it's a really good point. And I think it's cyclical, or at least for me it has been, and I'd like to share my experience in this friendly and safe circle and see if you guys have had similar experiences where I go into a new environment being as extroverted as possible. Like, I am the man. I am the life of the party, to the point of obnoxiousness. I did it in high school, secondary school, we call it, right? Then I did it in sixth form, which is before university. Then I did it in university. I was there. I'm like, yo, I am here. I am alive. This is my universe. This is my circle.
Did you enjoy being my friend. Being like that?
Huh?
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah,
did it give you that
definitely
rush?
Because you know, within a few days, when you go into a new environment, right, and nobody knows each other, the person who has the upper hand is the one who
gets his foot in the door first, right?
So
definitely.
Everybody knew me, like from day one. That's the guy. That's Muzaffar.
Who did they know you as?
I have so many nicknames. I have Shrek 2. That's a long story. I have Muzaffar. I have Muzzy, Prince Muzz.
That was mostly
self-given. Dodger. Dodger was a good one. Packy, the N-word. Those are there too. I have like
okay,
a
and
couple.
Now how has that changed?
Muzz Sparrow is one of them.
But now, you're not like that
anyway, my point was, right? Super extrovert, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody knows you. Popular, famous, you know, all that stuff. Then, after a month, after 2 months, maximum 3 months, maybe let's say half a year, right? After that, you're just bored.
You're just burnt out.
And then what happens is you kind of retreat. You're just like, and everybody's making the same jokes. Mm. You know, like, hey, remember that time that you did that thing with the thing? And I'm like, yeah. And it's just not fulfilling. And you have a huge circle of people who know you,
but
none of them.
Anymore.
No, you don't enjoy it. None of them who understand you. You still end up with just one or two
close
friends.
Okay, so now I am detecting more underlying factors to your personality, which we're going to come back to.
Hold on. So let me just finish this. I know I've taken so much time. I need to get your opinion on this, but. That happened in high school. Then that happened in sixth form. Then that happened in university. Then that happened in the workplace to an extent. Then you come to the Halsa. Mm-hmm. And I think it's been a similar thing, although I didn't go in like, you know, completely extroverted. Mm-hmm. I wasn't obnoxious or anything. At least I hope I wasn't.
Because you were older.
Right. I was more older, more mature and stuff. I was like, oh, let me take it easy. But even then, you've suddenly gotten to a point where you're just like, okay, now I'm burned out, and it's going to sound too confrontational if I say I don't care anymore, you know. I don't want to say
really
it like that.
But you literally don't care.
Yeah, but it's just like, you know, I'm too tired to care.
Yeah. Brother Hassan, have you ever experienced that sort of thing? You feel you identify yourself as a genuine extrovert who enjoys...
No, like, wait, what I think is, you know, there's a thin line between being extrovert and being an introvert. Like, knowing the fact, you know, the introverts are not really introvert with their own people or the people they're close to.
Mm.
So...
But see, an extrovert has... If an extrovert has 10 people they're comfortable being close to and they can spend time with on a weekly basis, an introvert probably only has 2.
But
and I think that's a substantial difference.
We all need the same thing. We need people we're close to, like our best friends or someone.
Yeah, I know. But the number of that best friend, it differs because extroverts... enjoy and have the talent to connect and click with more people, you know.
That's just at the beginning, right? Like, you know, at the beginning, you know, an extrovert, like, you know, can like start a conversation with anybody.
Mm.
So that thing, you know, an introvert doesn't do that.
No,
like once that stranger becomes his close friend, like he's okay, really
that stranger will almost never become my close friend. Like, this is very interesting, though. I think the universe is trying to tell something. Because before, when we just came to the studio, something came up. And then Brother Mudafa, out of the blue, remember? Mm. You said, like, how do you feel about new friends or new acquaintances, Sister Zainab? And I was like, no, my quota is, like, met. I do not want new friends. I make acquaintances and that's it. Like 99%, I'm not even doing this to be rude mm-hmm. or inconsiderate. 99% of the time, if I meet that acquaintance again on the street, I won't even say hi.
Now,
I can't.
To an extrovert, that sounds crazy. It's like, why would you not want new friends? Hmm. That's bizarre. And to an extent, it's...
Like, literally, no longer have anyone on my list of people I know whom I haven't known for at least 10 years. And I don't add anyone to that list anymore. This is Back to Reality, and we are talking about the lifestyle and career path most suitable for introverts and extroverts. We'll be back after a short break, so stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
You're listening to Back to Reality, and we're talking about the most suitable lifestyle and career path for introverts and extroverts. Just a reminder, disclaimer, we are not experts here. We're not therapists, we're not psychologists, we're not sociologists. We're just people talking off our own personal experiences. Funnily enough, I, the host, I'm a total introvert. Brother Hassanein, my guest, is an extrovert. And Brother Mudafad?
I'm in the middle.
Yes.
I'm in the middle.
He's an extrovert leaning toward being an introvert.
You know, I go somewhere. And I know that, you know, okay, I meet some people, like, I know that I won't be meeting this person again.
Mm-hmm.
So, like yesterday, like, my experience, like, I went on a road trip with a different school. So, we went out somewhere, like, to a farmhouse.
Why would you do that?
No, it was my friend over there, like, my really close friend.
Oh, okay, fine.
So, I went with him. So, all of his mates, like, his classmates, I don't know them.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I'm not going to meet those people again.
Mm-hmm.
So... We just,
how did you interact with them?
Like, it was good, like, you know, asking about, you know, talking about different stuff.
Oh, first of all, I probably wouldn't have gone on that trip at all. And even if I did, I would have probably not struck up a conversation with anyone. I would probably just whisper something to my best friend and it's just...
Okay, you know, for Muslims, there's one thing. A conversation starts with salam.
Yeah, salam alaikum, and I'd smile. Like,
yeah, and the religion of Islam is an incredibly social religion as well.
It is,
of course. Praying in jama'ah, you know, going to the masjid, meeting with people, and family life, and
but with anyone, even if you're an introvert, you know, the conversation starts with the greetings, like salam, how are you?
But I'm never the one who to say the salam first. I know it's wrong of me. Guys, you don't understand. I have social anxiety. Like, I literally get physically ill in a social environment. I'm never the one to say the salam first, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if they do, I'm not going to be like, no, I'm going to smile with amiable alaikum assalam, and I might even throw in a lovely weather, you know, because to keep it Islamically ethical. But I have no plans on making new friends, no plan on bringing that person I met once into my acquaintance list or bringing them into my life circle whatsoever.
Whether you're an introvert or an extrovert,
mm.
if anybody is asked to find one person in their life who fully... at least to an extent, understands them, would they be able to come up with anybody? If they come up with one, I'd be surprised. Or two, I'd be surprised. But isn't that the case always?
Do you have a person who you think understands you 90%, Brother Hassani?
I guess.
That's amazing. Do you?
No.
I don't either.
Hell no.
I feel like my cat understands me the most.
Nobody understands. Prophet Ibrahim is known as Khalil Allah. I think it's because Allah understood him.
And no one else. All the prophets, in fact.
All the prophets are like that.
Nabi Musa was Kalimullah because he could only talk to God. No one else would get him.
Yeah. Brother.
Yeah.
You get a bit older. That number is going to come down to zero. I'm so sorry.
How old are you? That is a good. How old are you, even?
I'll be 21 next week.
You know what?
We're like envious.
All of a sudden, everything makes sense. Yeah. First of all, happy
Happy being
early,
young.
Early happy birthday. Thank you so much. Happy birthday in advance. Thank I you hope so it's much. A prosperous year filled with fulfillment and happiness and more good friends.
For the dunya and akhirah.
And yeah, and health and Thank wealth so and spiritual well-being. Oh my God, I'm so happy for you. But yeah, a little down the 20 line and you're going to find yourself pretty gosh darn introverted.
Man, look.
That's all the time we have, isn't it?
The world is cruel. It's no, cruel. It's time. Full of cruelty. That this whole thing about it being like lovely and everybody being your friend, it's all a lie, right? It's all it is all a lie. And
no, it really is. Even if we look at it from an Islamic way, when Allah when the hadith says ad-dunya sijn al-mu'min, this world is the prison of a believer, no one enjoys being imprisoned.
No.
Right? Even if your cell guard, okay, is the kindest, but the point is no one enjoys being in a cell.
And this dunya is a cell.
It is.
And all the other people in this cell are cellmates. That's what they are. You don't want to be with them. You're just stuck with them.
He doesn't mean that.
No, I do. You had so much fun on that trip because you never knew the people. And you're never going to meet them again.
Yeah, it's lovely. If you get to know them for who they are.
That's the thing I had in my mind. Like, oh, okay, so I'm not going to meet these people again. Let's just enjoy the time.
And I think that's a very good mentality to have our entire lives.
If we could develop that
but
and
we
recognize
can't.
That dunya is just a road.
But we can't. You know why? Because we have feelings. $10 says, if one of those strangers hurt your feeling in the slightest bit, that one-day trip would have been entirely dark for you, right? Just because you're an extrovert doesn't mean that your heart is made of steel.
Yeah, of course.
Right?
Yeah, I have hopes from nobody except Allah.
Exactly. And I think now that you're 20 and you're more your heart and your feelings are more pristine and you're more wide-eyed and innocent, you feel like, the world is a good place, you know? It didn't have much time to hurt you yet. But once it does, you're going to realize like, yeah, no, I'm done. I'm done. This is Back to Reality and we're talking about the best life and career path for introverts and extroverts. I think extroverts are more tolerant of other people.
I don't hate anybody.
Right? Are they? Are you? Do you feel you're more tall? I can't.
Extroverts are way
more tolerant of people, right? And what was the last time you felt like, okay, I hate this person?
Apart from your teachers.
And me. And politicians.
I don't know.
Oh my God,
he's
never hated anyone before.
Nah, yes, of course.
You have not lived.
I have.
Until you have truly hated.
I have, but like, you know, I don't let the hate remain in my heart.
Definitely,
that's the thing.
Yeah. That's the key. Whether you're an extrovert or an introvert, don't let malice and the hate and the darkness remain in your heart. We're out of time. That's all the time we have for today's episode of Back to Reality. Whether you're an extrovert or an introvert, I hope you guys enjoyed our discussion and I hope you guys could relate to it a little bit. Until another episode, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim. يا ربي لدي أمار عزك
يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك لتصي دليلتك once again.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
At least 1,500 Palestinian residents in Silwana Lots are at risk of ethnic cleansing in favor of a Jewish tourist park to be established on the site of their historic neighborhood. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Boxbaum Ryder. This article is published under the heading American Tax Dollars Financing Israeli Regime Tourist Park Atop Historic Palestinian Neighborhood. Stay tuned for more. Roughly 2.5 miles from Sheikh Jarrah, the Palestinian neighborhood that grabbed the world's attention in May, lies Silwan. This neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds is perched atop the steep slopes just outside the old city. Houses are tightly compacted and stacked on top of each other as they dip into the valley below. And here, Palestinian residents face the same fate as their brethren in Sheikh Jarrah. The Zionist regime forces raided the Al-Bustan neighborhood in Silwan with bulldozers on June 29th, razing a butcher shop and dispersing Palestinian protesters defending their homes with tear gas, stun grenades, batons, and rubber-coated steel bullets. At least 13 people were injured and 6 arrested, including the owner of the butcher shop, Nidal Al-Rajabi, and his sons and brothers. In regard to the recent demolition, Norwegian Refugee Council's Palestine County Director Caroline Ord said in a press release, under the 4th Geneva Convention, Israel has an obligation to protect civilians under its occupation and to refrain from destroying private property. Al-Rajabi's store was destroyed on the pretext of lacking a building permit. Various human rights organizations involved in the issue state conflicting numbers, but according to Fakhri Abu Diab, spokesman for Silwan, 16 buildings in Al-Bustan are also at immediate risk of being torn down. About 1,500 Palestinians live in more than 100 houses in Al-Bustan. On June 7th, 2 structures, including the butcher shop, received notices from the municipality of Al-Quds to self-demolish their homes within 21 days, or municipality authorities would do so and charge the residents the demolition fees, calculated about $6,000. Amy Cohen, Director of International Relations and Advocacy at Ir Amim, Al-Quds nonprofit, told Min Press News the second structure, a residential unit, has yet to receive a visit from municipality inspectors. According to Ir Amim, 68 homes in Al-Bustan have pending demolition orders so as to execute the Al-Quds municipality's King Garden plan. The municipality outlined the initiative in 2010, stating the King's Garden area, Al-Bustan in Arabic, will be developed into a tourist and residential district, commercial sections, restaurants, and art galleries will be built, turning it into a bustling tourist zone. For the first time, the local residents will have the legitimate right to live in this neighborhood. The development plan has not moved forward since 2010, but the municipality's recent objection to extending the demolition freeze suggests the plan could be reactivated. In February, the Al-Ghots municipality filed an objection in the local affairs court against Al-Bustan's residents' request to extend the demolition freeze, arguing the proposed zoning plan for the area doesn't follow proper guidelines and isn't advancing quick enough. In March, the court ruled to extend the demolition freeze until August 15th. Negotiations have been ongoing between the municipality and the residents to develop a suitable zoning plan for Al-Bustan since 2005. In 2009, the residence plan was rejected by the municipality in favor of the King's Garden plan. According to Murad Abu Shafi, an Al-Bustan resident who received the demolition order, the municipality told the residents, "This structure plan can't happen in Israel. This might happen in Europe or any Arab country, but not here. Our plan was very modern, and it doesn't fit with the Israeli regime's standards for East Al-Quds," Abu Shafi explained. "The Zionist regime doesn't want us to have a modern neighborhood. They want us always to be below the line." Despite the local court's ruled extension, 20 demolition cases, including the butcher's shop order, were excluded from the freeze due to the Zionist regime Kamenetz law, known as Amendment 116 to Planning and Building Law, which was fully enacted in 2019. This legislation intensifies enforcement against unauthorized construction and allows for little legal intervention in preventing demolitions of structures built after 2017. The amendment has been partially frozen since 2020 amid ongoing discussions with Palestinian parliamentary members in the Israeli regime. In a statement to Mint Press News, the Al-Quds municipality said there is no intention to build a biblical garden in the area. "This is a false claim. The area is designated for gardens and parks for the benefit of local residents of Silwan." The vast majority of demolition orders in Al-Bustan are suspended. There are a few demolition orders that the court has recently decided to unfreeze. It should be emphasized that these orders are old and no new orders were issued whatsoever. As to the execution of these orders, the municipality is obliged to act in accordance with the law and with the court rulings. We are still studying the latest ruling profoundly and will decide on our next steps according to the situation on the ground. The municipality noted that Al-Bustan is designated as a green area because of its location near the Kidron River. Jeff Halper, director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, explained that when Israel annexed East Al-Quds in 1967 following the Six-Day War, it declared the entirety of East Al-Quds as open green space, meaning the area is frozen for future building. Halper pointed out the hypocrisy of this development policy in how Israel treats settlement building versus Palestinian building, explaining, "Today, more than 100,000 Israelis live in East Al-Quds in these big settlements. But if East Al-Quds was frozen 100% for building, then how did you get all that building for Israelis? The answer is, Israel rezones for Jewish settlements. But when a Palestinian wants to build, Israel says, 'Sorry, this area isn't zoned for residential development, but for open green space.' So it's really the use of bureaucracy and law and planning as tools of control." Construction in Al-Bustan was done primarily by Palestinian residents themselves on their own land, but often without the necessary building permits. Er Amims Cohen explained this is mostly owing to a lack of viable zoning plans rather than the municipality's flat-out rejection of building permits. With the absence of an outline plan, residents are precluded from acquiring the permits. "You either have a lack of a zoning plan or you have such outdated zoning plans, which are from, say, 30 to 40 years ago, that it's impossible to then receive building permits, and this is a very acute way that the Israeli regime authorities have neglected their municipal responsibility to provide this service. Cohen concluded, since 1967, this has been a means to suppress Palestinian building and planning within Palestinian areas. Silvan is located in Holy Basin, an area coveted by religious settlers for its proximity to the Old City and alleged connections to King David. Er David or Elat settler organization runs the City of David National Park in Al-Bustan area since 1990s. Elat has sought to transform Silvan into a symbol of Jewish biblical past. Al-Bustan is specifically targeted because it stands as an obstacle to achieving Er David's vision of a biblical paradise. Elat's actions aren't focused solely on building settlements, but also on promoting archaeological excavations, tourist attractions, and parks. According to the Foundation for West Asia Region Peace Process report on Al-Bustan, the settlers' goals became the official policy of the Israeli regimes in 2005, when then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's regime approved plans to develop the Holy Basin area. In essence, the DNA of Elat's biblical ideology became the DNA of the Israeli regime in and around the Old City, with the regime outsourcing many of its authorities to Elat in order to pursue these objectives. FMEP wrote in its report, the lines between the regime and the settlers became so blurred that they almost disappeared. Odeh, whose family faces displacement in Al-Bustan and in Al-Batan Al-Hawa, another neighborhood in Silvan and settler target, described the deep interconnections between settlers and the Zionist regime, citing as an example that Aryeh King is Al-Quds deputy mayor, but is also a notorious settler leader responsible for displacing Sheikh Jarrah residents. These settler organizations are the people running the regime, Odeh said. They receive full support from the military and any ministry and municipality. Er David isn't just supported by the Israeli regime, but also backed by American money. Er David's sister nonprofit in the U.S., Friends of Er David, secures tax-exempt donations for the organization. According to a January investigation by Mint Press News, Hertog Foundation, Irving I, Moskowitz Foundation, Adelson Family Foundation, Mindel Foundation, Samueli Foundation, Jay and Jeannie Scottstein Foundation, and Jewish Communal Fund have all donated to Friends of Er David. The organization's biggest contributors are the Irving Moskowitz and Adelson Family Foundations. In 2018, the Irving Moskowitz Foundation gave Friends of Er David $1.5 million, and the Adelson Family Foundation contributed about $3 million. The Er David Foundation did not respond to a request for comment.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.